فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Well, we have been talking for a few sessions now about the different levels of nafs, the human soul, and what the ulama of irfan and ethics have termed as nafs. We have talked about nafsi ammara, nafsi lawama, and nafsi mutmainna. And there are other stages of the nafs that are good to know, of course. And these categories of nafs have been discussed in detail by different scholars, of course. So, as I said, the human soul or the human nafs has the capacity and the potential to embark on a journey of perfection, traversing the path and passing through the stages and levels one after another. So, one stage is covered, then there is another stage. The road to perfection is endless. And there's no limitation, there's no boundary when it comes to how much perfection we can achieve when we are trying and endeavoring to gain proximity to Allah. But of course, moving from one stage to another stage and achieving perfection is an uphill task. It's always difficult, but it's always also possible for human beings to achieve perfection. And perfection is something achievable. You know, philosophically speaking, or, you know, talking from any perspective, achieving perfection is possible. Moving from one stage, from one level, from one station to another station of the nafs is quite possible. And of course, in your journey to Allah, you can get as close to Allah as the angels. There's no restriction whatsoever. There's no limit to achieving perfection. The Quran says in chapter Al-Qamar, verse 54 and verse 55, surely those who guard against evil shall be in the gardens and rivers, in the seat of honor with a most powerful king. What does this verse signify? This verse clearly signifies that if you want to achieve perfection, there is no hurdle, there is no limit to achieving perfection. You can get as close to Allah as the angels. Dear brothers and sisters, the goal of life is to achieve perfection. The verses which I recited clearly suggest that those who observe piety and are God conscious will be in gardens and rivers. They will have, you know, the blessings. وَلَكُمْ فِيهَا مَا تَشْتَهِي أَنفُسُكُمْ وَلَكُمْ فِيهَا مَا تَدَّعُونَ. And of course, gardens and rivers obviously point to God's boundless blessings and mercy upon men. That's the reward for those who are God conscious, who are mindful of their duties to Allah. Now, brothers and sisters, we have discussed the different levels of nafs. And in this episode, as I promised in the beginning, we will have a brief look at nafsi mulhima. This is another verse which has been referred to and also pointed out in one of the verses of the Quran, where it says, وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا. By the soul and the proportion and order given to it, then he inspired it to understand what is right and wrong for it. He will indeed be successful who purifies it. This is the translation of the verses. وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا. What is نَفْسِ مُلْهِمَة? نَفْسِ مُلْهِمَة has been translated as the balanced and inspired self, and it's the fourth level. It is the state in which the good has begun to predominate in this struggle. The tyranny of egoism has been overcome, and a more or less integrated self is attained. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand it crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves, we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The quality awakened here is the renunciation of worldly longings, zuhd, and ambitions. There is no desire for worldly longings. There is freedom from the conditionings of desire. There is actually a state in which one is delivered from the lower self, from the carnal desires, and one is detached from what is evil. Although it's the fourth level of human development, it's no minor accomplishment. It's a very important accomplishment. For some people, it requires a great deal of personal and psychological work, and of course, to achieve this stage. It's not an easy stage to achieve. This is a stage, this is a level when the seeker of perfection and truth is rewarded for his efforts. He is rewarded for his persistence and for his obedience to highest self and to his Lord. Now he occasionally receives messages from inside of himself, soundless, wordless inspirations. That's what I can describe, which give him direction, encouragement, and the strength to continue in his advancement. This is what Nafs Mulhima is about. The Nafs shows man the direction towards the good, the path towards good. But yet there are, of course, still grave dangers. The devil is capable of imitating divine inspirations. These dangers are there. The seeker of truth, the seeker of perfection, may not be able to differentiate between them and those inspirations, you know. That's why at this stage he needs help. He should stick to the guidance of the Quran and the Prophet, and he will have to be able, and he should be able, to distinguish the true inspirations from the false imaginations. This is what some scholars have said. But of course, when it comes to this stage, there are different views, there are different opinions, but this is the dominant and the preponderant opinion about Nafs-i Mulhima. Now, dear brothers and sisters, we have run out of time. And as I said, in order for a person to achieve perfection and to live a better life, to traverse the path of perfection and the path of happiness, he should understand himself. He should build and develop self-knowledge and knowledge of the different stages and stations of the self. And he should understand that he can move from one level to another, and he can be as close to Allah as the angels. And there is no limit, there is no impediment or restriction when it comes to achieving perfection. The more perfection you achieve, the more room is there to achieve more perfection. Inshallah, that will be all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration is threatening the well-being of millions of Afghans, while also undermining the ability of civil society organizations to respond to the crisis, says Ashley Submanian Montgomery Ryder in an article published under the heading, U.S. is effectively stealing billions from a nation ravaged by a U.S.-initiated war. Stay tuned for more. President Joe Biden recently declared a national emergency in the name of addressing the dual threats of the massive humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Afghanistan, as well as the potential for a deepening economic collapse in Afghanistan. In sharp contrast, his decision to unilaterally assert the U.S. authority to redistribute $7.1 billion of Afghanistan's frozen funds as it sees fit was dead wrong. In declaring the national emergency, the president laid out his administration's vision for Afghanistan's funds, should U.S. courts voice their approval, that half be made available pending litigation to the families of 9/11 victims who have claims against Taliban for its role in harboring Al-Qaeda. The remaining $3.5 billion would go towards humanitarian efforts. Setting aside the moral and political problems inherent in the U.S. effectively stealing billions of dollars from a nation ravaged by a U.S.-initiated war and the resulting humanitarian and economic devastation, the president's failure to make any of these funds immediately available to the people of Afghanistan in their hour of need is unforgivable. In abdicating responsibility to the courts, which may take months to decide how these frozen funds can be redistributed, the Biden administration is threatening the well-being of millions of Afghans, while also undermining the ability of civil society organizations to respond to the crisis. This is in direct opposition to the beacon of human rights the United States claims to be. To say that Afghanistan is in urgent need is to understand the severity of the situation. 24 million Afghans, nearly 60% of the population, need humanitarian aid. Some 23 million face acute food insecurity, meaning their lives are in immediate danger. And over 1 million children are at risk of death due to severe acute malnutrition. While Afghanistan has faced humanitarian challenges for years as a result of conflict, U.S. occupation and natural disasters, the current situation is markedly worse, in no small part due to U.S. policies towards Afghanistan in the wake of the takeover. When the Taliban took control of the country last August, the Biden administration froze $7.1 billion in Afghanistan's foreign reserves held in the U.S., money that belongs to the Afghan people. And that prior to the takeover, the Central Bank of Afghanistan, that is the Afghanistan Bank, had been using to maintain economic stability. The resulting liquidity crisis has led to massive inflation alongside depreciation of the Afghani, whose value the Central Bank can no longer stabilize by selling off its foreign reserves. Many banks in Afghanistan have dramatically limited the amount of money account holders can withdraw, while others have closed entirely. Businesses no longer able to pay their employees have shuttered, leading to rampant unemployment. The price of food has risen, while the value of the Afghani has plummeted, leading to mass starvation. As a further result of freezing these funds and U.S. sanctions that have led risk-averse banks to severely limit access to financial services in Afghanistan, local and international aid groups and other civil society organizations in Afghanistan are struggling to pay their staff and provide services to the millions of Afghans in need. Kate Phillips Barroso, Director of Humanitarian Policy at Interaction, a network of humanitarian aid organizations, recently explained that financial service providers just don't want to get involved. There is a lot of risk aversion. Financial institutions say, even with explicit permission, it still reeks of efforts and risk, and it's better to just not provide the service. As a result, aid organizations are turning to informal cash transfer networks, which entail greater risk and higher fees. Some have also turned to cryptocurrency as another means of getting funds into the country, despite challenges arising from limited use of cryptocurrency among much of the population. While these workarounds have offered some relief, limited access to cash and financial services is still plaguing the humanitarian aid sector as a direct result of U.S. policy. The Biden administration must urgently reconsider and correct its policies towards Afghanistan and towards Afghanistan's foreign reserves in particular. Shah Mehrabi, a member of the Supreme Council of Afghanistan Central Bank and a professor of economics at Montgomery College, has called on the U.S. administration to allow the Central Bank of Afghanistan limited, monitored, and conditional access to $150 million per month from Afghanistan's foreign reserves, citing the central bank's independence from the Afghan government and the U.S. ability to monitor how the funds are dispersed. Some form of a phased release of the frozen funds has widespread support, including from members of the U.S. Congress, the United Nations, and prominent international aid groups, human rights groups, and women's human rights and peace groups. Beyond releasing the frozen funds, the Biden administration must also lift sanctions on Afghanistan, which have done almost nothing to incentivize the Taliban to change its policies. Instead, sanctions have unleashed a chilling effect on national and international banking in Afghanistan by shutting down access to financial services, causing dire repercussions to Afghan lives and preventing civil society groups from addressing the crisis. While the U.S. Treasury Department has issued piecemeal general licenses aimed at enabling civil society organizations to continue their work in Afghanistan, these necessary but insufficient steps have failed to address the financial access issues caused by sanctions, let alone the liquidity crisis caused by freezing Afghanistan's foreign reserves. There is room for honest debate about precisely how, not if, these frozen funds should be returned to the people of Afghanistan and which, if any, sanctions should remain in place. However, there is no room or time to cling to a status quo that is starving Afghanistan's people and its economy.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Gjezeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Gjezeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult. Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just poor people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison. Not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
The government of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is in trouble. His cabinet has invoked a rarely used emergency ordinance to quell anti-vaccine truck protests that have crippled the country. The Emergency Act can authorize the use of the military. It can also temporarily suspend citizens' rights to free movement or assembly, and the government is taking steps to stop financial support of illegal protests. The measure allows Canadian banks to freeze accounts suspected of funding the blockades and suspend insurance on vehicles in the protests. Trudeau has noted that the measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate. The Canadian law, which was passed in 1988, says, "For the purpose of this act, a national emergency is an urgent and critical situation of a temporary nature that cannot be effectively dealt with under any other law of Canada." Trudeau said, "The government is not overriding the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, nor limiting the right to peaceful assembly."
The federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act to supplement provincial and territorial capacity to address the blockades and occupations.
The plan has drawn widespread condemnation from Canadians, including the Premier in Quebec, Francis Legault, who said Trudeau's announcements risk putting oil on the fire. The trouble all began after thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles blocked the streets of Ottawa, as well as two border crossings with the U.S. to vent their frustration over COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The protests have not stayed in Canada, though. Similar freedom convoy protests have grown in countries like the U.S., France, New Zealand, Australia. As common with protests, many have also vented their anger against the government due to their economic situation as a result of COVID-19.
Spontaneous thing where people are upset. That's one whole part of this, and it's part of a general movement, I think, that we're seeing around the world of the ultra-right asserting itself and using the money of the millionaires to do it.
The so-called Freedom Convoy protests started with truckers protesting COVID-19 vaccine or quarantine mandate. It then broadened to include people opposing all coronavirus-related restrictions announced by the Trudeau government. The protest has attracted the support of thousands of Canadians, even some who are fully vaccinated. They say all COVID-19 preventive measures must be dropped. The protests have drawn support from groups from the U.S.
Jabbing is a right-wing attack on all kinds of things, because one of the demands of the people in Canada was that Trudeau should resign, and the other was that the western part of the country should secede. So, you know, these are not just little political things. So you have, in Canada in particular, the implementation of a very conservative right-wing agenda. And everybody agrees on that, especially the right-wing who's doing it. So this isn't just some kind of, you know, spontaneous thing where people are upset.
Canadian authorities have said about half of the funding for the protests has come from U.S. supporters. Toronto Dominion Bank last week froze two personal bank accounts that received $1.4 million for the protests. In the western Canadian province of Alberta, police have broke up a group that was armed and prepared to use violence. The protests that have hindered traffic at border crossings have impacted more than $500 million in commerce each day.
I think that what happened was that the automobile companies complained. You know, there's production shut down, millions of dollars lost. And it was pretty clear that that was very unpopular. And he waited long enough for the economy to be heard and people to be heard and said, enough's enough. And I think the balance of forces changed a bit because of that.
Truckers and their supporters have gathered in the capital, Ottawa, since January 29th to rally against mask mandates, lockdowns, restrictions on gatherings, and other COVID-19 preventive measures. Some downtown Ottawa businesses have had to shut down temporarily. There have been reports of rock throwing, property damage, harassment, and even hate crimes.
Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood made headlines once again on Sunday. Clashes broke out between Israeli forces and Palestinian residents in the area after far-right Jewish lawmaker Itamar Ben-Gvir opened a parliamentary office in Sheikh Jarrah. Tens of Palestinians were injured in the Israeli crackdown. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates condemned Ben-Gvir's step as a provocative and escalating move that threatens to ignite violence. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says the Israeli regime is fully and directly responsible for the escalation in the occupied Al-Quds and potentially dire consequences of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. It added that the failure of the international community and the United Nations Security Council to take necessary measures to compel Israel to stop its occupation of Al-Quds encourages the occupying power to forge ahead with its colonial Judaization projects in the Holy City.
Well, that was expected, and he did it largely as a publicity stunt and to raise his profile within Zionist politics in Israel, and of course to shove it in the face of the Palestinian Christian and Arab or Muslim community that lives in the area. But it was designed for controversy. But it definitely is a political stunt, and it's designed to increase tensions in the area. And this is most unfortunate and illegal, and mostly condemned around the world as an attempt to Judaize the area and to drive out the Palestinians.
Earlier, the Hamas resistance movement had issued a strongly worded message of warning to the Israeli regime and settlers after the latter renewed their attacks on Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Mohammed Hamadeh, a spokesman for the Gaza-based movement, said the attack amounts to a clear violation and that Israel was playing with fire. Israel's attempts to evict families from the Flashpoint Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood resulted in an 11-day war between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups and Israel back in May. Israel is evicting Palestinians to make way for its settlement-building activities. This is while under international law, all Israeli settlements are deemed illegal. The United Nations Security Council has condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Al-Quds remains at the heart of the decades-long conflict, with Palestinians insisting that East Al-Quds, illegally occupied by Israel since 1967, must serve as the capital of a Palestinian state. In the meantime, the Al-Aqsa Mosque has had enormous significance throughout the years. In the year 2000, an Israeli official's visit to the holy site provoked a Palestinian uprising known as the Second Intifada. Observers believe any escalation of violence or provocative action by Israeli forces in the Holy City could serve as a prelude to a new intifada.
It is part of the Judaization of East Jerusalem, and it's an attempt by Zionists to drive the Christian and Muslim Arabs out of the city and increase the Jewish population.
Emboldened by former U.S. President Donald Trump's unqualified support, Tel Aviv expanded its illegal activities against the people of Palestine. Many were expecting a turn of events when Trump left office, but the regime continues to carry out its acts of aggression in the absence of any meaningful action from the international community.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini court's dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir la'inir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We are looking at justice, a concept that is essential for the existence of mankind. And we're looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. When it comes to justice, it requires people to establish it. And obviously it goes into levels. Me and you being commoners or being citizens of a government or a system, we have to apply justice to one another. We have to be fair to one another. On a higher scale, we need a government, we need a person in power to make sure and to maintain that justice is applied in society and to everyone, and no one should be exempt and no one should be over the law, as we say. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he brought in a very delicate point in this regard. He said that khilafah and leadership and kingship and whatever you want to call it, or power, does not mean that people should be subjected at the point of the sword by means of bloodshed and force, and they should obey the ruler or the khalif on the account of fear. On the contrary, because sometimes those who come to power, they think they can establish justice by installing fear into the hearts of their subjects, in the hearts of the citizens, and they think that I am doing justice. And even now, when you look at governments who are past, even to until recently, people are looking at tyrants as justice upholders. Why? Because at their time, everyone was doing things perfectly out of fear, obviously. And they said, oh, you know what? Look at that system before. It was perfect. Everyone was doing the right thing. Nothing was going wrong. They don't realize that people at that time, they have lost their ability to speak, their ability to freedom, their ability to do things. Their rights were taken from them. Now, here where Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam comes into play. We've all heard the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, where he said, I worship Allah not because I desire forgiveness or heaven, not because I fear punishment. I worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because I find him deserving of it. Now, that itself is a law Amir al-Mu'mineen has set. That when you deal with Allah, it has to be you have to deal with him based on the fact that he is deserving of it. That Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the supreme, is the just. He does not take the rights of people. That he says, Amir al-Mu'mineen, along these lines, that when you have a ruler, when you have a king in power, he has to be obeyed based on the fact that he is deserving of it, not because we fear him. So when we have a king or leader or what have you, if he's applying the justice of Allah, if he's being fair to people, giving them their rights, then I and you should give our obedience to him, not because we fear him, not because we are under a threat, not because we have no choice, no, because we say that person is deserving of it. Now, let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we said that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam wanted to establish the notion that when there's a ruler, he needs to be obeyed based on the fact that he is deserving of obedience. With Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself, he required the obedience of people. This obedience, is it going to increase the, you know, the treasury of Amir al-Mu'mineen? Would it give him more deeds in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Would it make him more richer, more stronger, more powerful? On the contrary, he said, the more obedient you are to me, obviously based on the fact that I am deserving of such obedience, it means I am serving you well. It means I am being at your service. It means I am giving you rights. It means I am applying the human rights. That's what it means. So if you obey me, you just make my job easier to make your lives much easier. Because when Amir al-Mu'mineen had to go to war with the people of the Camel, of the people of the Suffin, of the people of Nahrawan, those people did not give allegiance to Amir al-Mu'mineen or obedience to him. In return, they made it difficult for Amir al-Mu'mineen to establish justice, to establish human rights, to give people what they require. They made it difficult for him. But if people gave Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam obedience as he deserves, then you would have seen the course of history would have changed. And now that's the notion, and this is the ideology that Amir al-Mu'mineen brought forward, that he says, if you're in power, you require obviously the obedience of people, but such obedience has to come because you are deserving of it, meaning that you are serving the people, you are with the people, not that you live in your castles and you're enjoying your life and you're having your servants and everything is brought to you in golden plates while people in the streets are suffering. As a king, as a ruler, doesn't matter who you are, you need to be in the streets with people. You need to feel their pain. You need to see their suffering. You need to come to their help, to their aid. And that is exactly what Amir al-Mu'mineen did. He used to walk in the morning and in the afternoon in the markets of Kufa, going around making sure no one's rights have been taken, solving the problems of people, sitting with the commoners, holding up courts, judging between people. That was his primary job. He did not say, well, I am the king, I am the Khalifa. If you have any problem, go to court, go to the judges, they will deal with you. I am not going to walk in the market by myself. I need a parade, I need an army, I need bodyguards. That wasn't Amir al-Mu'mineen. He was with the people. And therefore, he was very deserving of obedience of people. And if people gave him full obedience at that time, then their lives would have been different. Their lives would have been literally a heaven. But sadly, people sometimes, as humans, we get greedy. And in the process, we lose and we don't give ourselves the rights that we deserve by ourselves. We cause our own destruction by ourselves. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله.
Does have tied to Muslim extremists, I don't know.
The bloody war in Yemen is back in the news. In recent weeks, the Saudi-led coalition has tightened the noose around the poorest country in the region. In late January, the coalition targeted a detention center, claiming some 70 people and wounding many more. It also hit a telecommunications center, knocking the country off the internet. The Saudis have speeded up their aggression since October, after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end its war crimes investigation following intensive lobbying by Riyadh.
So here we are again. People in Yemen who have endured years of horrific suffering, widely documented by the UN and Amnesty and others, have now been left without any kind of UN mechanism to either document or investigate those violations. So we all know that the UN system has failed them, allowing for a situation where bullying and bribing, corruption of the system has won the day. Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies shamelessly and aggressively lobbied states throughout their capital city and got rid of the Group of Eminent Experts, or GEE.
Yemen is starving to death. Almost every minute, a Yemeni child is dying of starvation. The impoverished country is also experiencing the worst cholera outbreak in recorded history. Against such a backdrop, the self-proclaimed champion of human rights has done nothing to stop this humanitarian tragedy. On the contrary, it's still giving military and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia and its cronies. Even congressional efforts have failed to prevent the White House from supporting the coalition.
It is long past overdue that Congress remove U.S. forces from Yemen, as recent circumstances only confirm. Today, we have the chance to remedy our course of action and to do what the Constitution and justice demand. The situation in Yemen is dire.
When Joe Biden came to office, he vowed to end the war.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But more than 1 year into his presidency, the U.S. keeps selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which keeps using them in its indiscriminate attacks. Surprisingly enough, the Biden administration approved a $650 million weapons sale to Saudi Arabia, which consisted of 280 AIM-120C air-to-air missiles that will be launched from Saudi Arabia's fighter jets. While described as defensive in nature, the sale angered even some Democrats, who say the non-stop flow of weapons from the U.S., regardless of their categorization, will only fuel the conflict. In other words, despite his anti-Saudi rhetoric, Biden has adhered, like his predecessors, to the traditional role of America in the region, following the preferences of the Saudi kingdom and the UAE and selling them more and more weapons. Upon the outbreak of the war, then-President Barack Obama declared that he had authorized U.S. forces to provide logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis in their military intervention in Yemen, establishing a joint planning cell with Saudi Arabia. Needless to say, under Donald Trump, the U.S. continued its support to the coalition. Until November 2018, that support included refueling Saudi warplanes that dropped bombs on Yemeni civilians, including children. The Trump administration ended the practice after increased pressure from activists and lawmakers about Riyadh's brutal conduct in the war.
Today, we tell the despotic regime in Saudi Arabia that we will not be part of their military adventurism. And today, maybe in the most profound way, 45 years ago, the War Powers Act was passed. 45 years ago. Today, for the first time, we are going to go forward utilizing that legislation and tell the President of the United States and any president, Democrat or Republican, that the constitutional responsibility for making war rests with the United States Congress, not the White House. Let us pass this resolution.
But Washington continues to provide logistical and intelligence support for the Saudis and plans to sell them billions in advanced weapons like precision-guided missiles. In 2019, Trump even vetoed a bipartisan bill which would have ended U.S. support for the Saudi-led military intervention.
So here we are asserting Congress's long-established responsibility oversight of our use of military force and also limiting Americans' engagement in this war, which has gone on far too long. I think we all agree. It's so sad. The president must sign this legislation. We're so proud of the bipartisan support, bicameral legislation that we will sending him to advance a peaceful, enduring solution to a horrific humanitarian crisis.
In the words of U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as long as we're providing intelligence sharing, spare parts, maintenance transfers, selling weapons, regardless if they're offensive or defensive in nature, or so-called offensive or defensive, we're going to see more violence. Since the beginning of the Yemen war, the Saudi-led coalition has been pounding the country with bombs, many of them supplied by the UK. In fact, London immediately expressed strong support for the Saudi-led campaign. The war saw sales of UK bombs for 2015 increase from £9 million to over £1 billion in 3 months. In September 2016, then UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson refused to block UK arms sales to Riyadh, arguing there was no clear evidence of breaches of international humanitarian law by the kingdom in the war in Yemen, and that it would be best for Saudi Arabia to investigate itself. According to the UK campaign group, Campaign Against Arms Trade, BAE Systems has sold £17.6 billion worth of arms and military services to the Saudi dictatorship since 2015.
In fact, we sold £1.4 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia in 3 months last year, including bombs and missiles that could be used in Yemen. Given everything we know about the appalling humanitarian cost of this war, with innocent civilians caught between the Saudi coalition and the Houthi rebels, why does the Prime Minister think it's right to be selling these weapons?
In April 2019, The Guardian revealed more than 40 Saudi officers had been trained at prestigious British military colleges since the start of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. While the World Food Programme warns it cannot feed Yemenis properly because of funding shortfalls, the UK slashed its humanitarian aid to Yemen by half in 2021. All in all, both the US and the UK have been providing, arming, refueling, and servicing Saudi warplanes, which have routinely struck weddings, funerals, apartments, markets, and other civilian targets. Although the two countries have enjoyed exemption from accountability, that doesn't change the reality on the ground. They are both accomplices to war crimes and have blood of innocent people on their hands.
IRIB English Radio.